Welcome back to Red Flags Rising. My name is Mike Hunneke. I am the co-chair of the Sanctions, Export Controls, and AML practice at Hughes, Hubbard & Reed. With me yet again is my good friend, Brent Carlson, a director at Berkeley Research Group out in the Bay Area. Brent, how are you doing today?
Very well. Thank you, Mike. Glad to be here and discuss important topics.
Brent, today we're going to record another episode looking at our Fresh Looks series that the NYU Law School's Program on Corporate Compliance and Enforcement has been graciously publishing for us for almost 2 years now. Brent, we're going to look back at a blog post we did specifically on risk assessments in the world of export controls enforcement. The post was titled, Know Your Customer, But Also Yourself, A Fresh Look at Sanctions and Export Controls Risk Assessments in the Era of the New FCPA.
I found the title of this quite interesting. So this was the second article we did in our Fresh Look series. Isn't this based on that classic phrase that comes out of ancient Greek philosophy, know thyself?
Yes, it is. Yep.
What was the inspiration behind that?
Well, you know, Brent, you and I were just starting at this point, and we published this blog post, September 28th, 2023. A lot of the experience I had had in the context of FCPA, Foreign Corrupt Practices Act work in particular, really focused on other people. Analyze the agent or the consultant who's involved, analyze the customer. Applying those concepts to export controls in particular, it's very challenging if you focus only on counterparties. When you're in global trade, you're dealing with tens of thousands of counterparties. If you're a big company, things are moving very quickly. You have to rely at some level on what they are telling you about themselves. You and I have written and spoken a lot since we put out this blog post on, well, then what does that leave you with as far as valuable inputs? Data that is reliable, that is not entirely within the control of counterparties. How do you begin to make credible decisions on this? And it's not just getting another end-use certificate. You know, the good people will sign it every time and it'll be true. The bad people will also sign it every single time and give you multiple of them. It's just not true. It's not a differentiating factor. It's like, I know you remember this, Brent, in the early days of Foreign Corrupt Practices Act enforcement, it was a big deal to get a rep and a warranty in an agreement, or a big deal to have a code of conduct. Well, now that's just the baseline. To me, we're already at a point in export controls enforcement where the end user certificate is the baseline, but it doesn't really tip the needle. It's not going to be convincing in front of a regulator who already has information and maybe intelligence that what is in the in-use certification is not true. So what do you do about that? One of the unlocks you and I had in thinking about this is to look inward, look at your own business, and not just at the moment in time, right? That's the other angle of this in this blog post, is the dynamic nature and the importance of the dynamic nature of an effective risk assessment looking at export controls enforcement risk. But what is your business? What is a normal month for you look like? What does a normal year for you look like? Who are your normal customers? How have those changed over time? Knowing market trends, knowing who the market players are, it's not really that difficult. There are people in your company, if you're in-house doing trade compliance, whose job is to know exactly that and to know it well. People know their business, and the government certainly is going to assume that you know your business. One of the key takeaways from the September 2024 updates to the DOJ's guidelines for effective corporate compliance programs, for example, was an expectation that the compliance team have access to the same data that the sales team has. That you don't have a sales team out there using highly customized Salesforce or other types of platforms where the compliance team is basically writing on a cave wall or using Excel, which is about the same thing these days. Looking at that, does it make sense? And let's give an example. So you know that for 10 years, you have had an incredible customer in Russia. You know that February of 2022, that customer, because of their ties to the defense industrial base in Russia or because of their ties to leadership in Russia, was sanctioned. You know that there were controls put in place that it restricted your ability to continue to sell that product to the same people. Suddenly, a new customer appears in, let's say, Central Asia, let's say Hong Kong, maybe it's a collection of customers. The first reaction is going to be, awesome, we can continue to sell the same product, the same quantity of product that we could before. It's almost like the war has no impact. That's something where knowing yourself as a company and knowing yourself in terms of your customer base tells you everything you need to know about the risks that these new customers bring, and certainly about what the government would perceive those new customers to be, just pass-throughs. So fairly or not, and a lot of times in corporate white-collar enforcement, it's unfairly, the effective burden would flip back to you to demonstrate how those were legitimate new sales that happened to appear.
Right.
That leads into the other axis of know yourself that we talked about. It's very important to not take a static moment in time. You're losing valuable information about changes in business, changes in trade flows over time that can be hugely valuable as a reliable data source when you're assessing your own risks. What are the ups and downs, the ebbs and flows of your market, of your industry? It's the change over time that really raises the red flags and export controls.
It sounds a lot like also with that example that you mentioned, just goes back to that example in the first article, when loopholes create liability pitfalls and what we refer to as entity shifting. And that scenario where if you've got a customer that then goes onto an entity list, and then all of a sudden there's a shift to subsidiaries, or you have these entities coming out of essentially the blue, those have to be treated very carefully. If you know your customer, you know yourself, you can avoid those perceived loopholes that actually may be liability pitfalls.
Totally, Brent.
I think also you made some good points in terms of watching things through time. That's another issue too, that axis of time and how things change. You know, businesses will have a seasonality to it. There'll be product cycles that are part of the mix. So all these are going to understanding when something is part of the normal course of business and something that's anomalous. We've got other posts that talk about how not to stand out like a sore thumb, because actually, if you know where to look, potentially risky transactions, characteristics that stand out like a sore thumb.
If people are wondering, yes, we are trying to use every possible metaphor in the titles of our blog posts.
Well, here, let me squeeze this a little. No, yeah. Exactly. In terms of compliance effectiveness and avoiding potential enforcement risks, it's prioritizing those resources to pay attention to those areas, as opposed to trying to look under every rock, which is impractical in nearly every sense. That just doesn't work. You're just wasting time on the wrong stuff. Or like in Indiana Jones, they're digging in the wrong place.
Exactly, Brent. The other advantage companies can get by looking at risks in this way is it happens to be how we've seen media look at this as well. Investigative journalists have been very good. Companies haven't always agreed that they've been good or that they've been accurate, but investigative journalists have been very good at pointing out in very clear terms and often with visual aids, trends over time that do not make sense in the way that they're being described. We've seen how many articles, Brent, with different charts, different graphs where sales to China, sales to Russia look a certain way, and then at key dates, at key moments in time, there's a drop and then something else spikes.
Yep.
Regulators are going to look at that exact same graph and then start asking you questions.
And they're going to start asking questions from that high probability standard of awareness perspective.
Right. Right. People appropriately recognize that a lot of the EAR is a strict liability regime, especially to companies or customers on the entity list where there really is no awareness or knowledge element. But you're exposing yourself to significant risk if that's all that you look at. Because for much of the EAR, including the catch-all end use and end user provisions, including General Prohibition 10, which is the, as I like to call it, the fallback catch-all, the catch-all of all catch-alls, to paraphrase an authoritarian figure from our childhood, you're going to miss important things. Those things turn on knowledge. It's not just what information was sitting with the trade compliance team. What did the sales team know? What did the customer relations team know?
What's this doctrine called?
The collective knowledge doctrine. They will be using the collective knowledge doctrine in those contexts to attribute the knowledge of any part of your company to the company. So if the way you're conducting risk assessments doesn't take into account the government's ability to bring civil enforcement actions on a high probability theory and to look through what just the compliance team might know or what might just be in the in-use certificates, then you are potentially underestimating the costs of noncompliance. One source of risk in the economic and national security area, Brent, especially compared to, say, corruption risk, is the battlefield effect. The Ukrainians have been very diligent in recovering things from the battlefield and forensically analyzing, well, what's inside of these things? How did Russia make these things? From where did they get the parts? And it's not just the Ukrainian government or the Ukrainian military intelligence officials. It's also NGOs like Conflicts Armament Research, who has essentially a mandate from the European Union to be doing battlefield assessments. That's a whole new ballgame, to borrow from yet another title of yet another article that we wrote. But that's a whole new ballgame in the sense that now, front and center on the front page of the news, proof of diversion or evasion is held up for the world to see. And there's photographs, there are raids of ships in the Red Sea, all kinds of stuff happening where diversion is there. It puts companies who manufacture those products in a difficult situation. There's no longer a doubt whether the product found itself to a bad place or got into the hands of someone looking to do bad things with it. That puts a huge amount of pressure on how did you control to whom your products were sent? This is massively difficult for anyone selling high quantities of small products. You know, semiconductors are like the perfect product for evasion and smuggling because of their size and because of their significance. It puts a huge pressure on what are you doing to ensure that your distributors and resellers are behaving and that what they say to you that they are doing, they are actually doing. This is especially difficult because private companies are not the police. They're not the intelligence community. If they're not in the banking sector, they don't necessarily have access to wire transfers as well. But when confronted with proof of diversion or evasion, not only the enforcement authorities are going to look to them for answers, but the media, the public are, shareholders are. We've seen that as well. You know, shareholders raising issues really from a humanitarian perspective. How could our products possibly be used to hurt people, to hurt children, to hurt families? Or in some cases, unfortunately, even to hurt U.S. soldiers who were killed, for example, in Jordan with drones that the Iranians made.
It's sort of like to take a line out of that great movie, A Few Good Men, where it's like, what evidence was there of a murder? You mean other than the dead body? If you find this stuff recovered in missiles and drones on the battlefield, that's difficult.
That's difficult. It's especially difficult when the discussion that we saw moved from how did Russia get this to really, well, how did Iran and North Korea get this? North Korea is a pariah state embargoed comprehensively for decades. How Iran could get these things, which really is in the same situation, raises a lot of questions as well.
In one sense, it's very simple. A lot of times, you've heard me say this, the answers are hidden in plain sight. Who's the largest trading partner for North Korea, Iran, in Russia? It's China. It's a China story.
Brent, thanks for your reference to things being hidden in plain sight. I've now made bingo on my cliche bingo card.
Yes!
Let's talk, Brent, about the obligation of officers and boards of directors. If you're a member of the board of directors or if you're an executive officer listening to this podcast, you might say, okay, guys, great, I get it. Much of the EAR requires not just actual knowledge. Violations can be found based on a high probability awareness. What do I need to do as a director, senior management of the company, to show that I'm attuned to this trend, that I'm attuned to not only the fact that this is how the law is written, but also to the fact that in July of last year, BIS issued guidance on this enforcement standard. In August of last year, BIS issued its first ever penalty through a settlement with the company. What do I do, Brent, if I'm on the board or if I'm in the C-suite?
The boards and the audit committees and the C-suite should be making sure that as part of their oversight duties for the compliance function is to make sure that the company's legal and compliance folks are looking at the export controls from that high probability standard perspective. So the first question would be, have we as a company incorporated the high probability standard into our compliance program? If you get a blank stare back at you or I don't know, then it's time to go chase that down. The second question would be, have we developed a protocol to incorporate that high probability standard into our compliance program? And if the answer is, I don't know, what time to go chase that down. And the third thing is always trust but verify, has testing of the compliance program included it from that perspective. This is where the enforcement is going to hinge, is on leveraging this high probability standard. That's how the government's going to pick it up, bring more enforcement actions, resolve them quicker with higher penalties. But companies can use that same high probability perspective to protect themselves, and officers and directors can use that to protect themselves.
What I hear you saying, Brent, is if you have a board meeting and someone comes in and says, well, we're managing export controls, and you say, as a member of the board, great, you know, how are we doing that? And they say, well, we got a guy. We've got someone in charge of that. 2 years ago, 3 years ago, maybe, that was probably going to be sufficient. 10 years ago, that was probably more than sufficient, frankly. It was the statements we've heard from the Secretary of Commerce and from the head of BIS. In today's environment, a better practice would be for the board to say, great, we hear you that we have somebody responsible for export controls compliance. That's great. How are they reflecting what the government is saying and the government's emphasis on the high probability standard for end use controls and for other things? For example, the several FDP rules turn on high probability awareness as well. How are we incorporating that into our program? Can we show BIS, if we're asked, that we have an effective program because where knowledge matters, we are not just looking at what we actually know, but looking at where we have an awareness of a high probability of an issue. And if you can show that because you have, for example, a protocol in place, you have a risk matrix that you've designed to focus on credible, reliable inputs of data to help you triage higher risks from lower risks, and you're focusing on those higher risks, then I think you can feel very good as a board and as a C-suite, not only that you have a person responsible for this subject area, but you have adapted your risk mitigation strategies to the present day environment.
To mitigate risk, start by knowing your customer, but also knowing yourself. Is that what you're
exactly.
saying?
Exactly, Brent. Yes, that's what I'm saying, and that's what we said. Yet again, by popular demand, is Brent Carlson's segment, Managing Up. Brent, risk assessments can be scary. They sound intimidating. They sound like a huge distraction to normal business. What can trade compliance people do to manage up in explaining, scoping, and executing risk assessments in today's export controls enforcement environment?
One thing that can be helpful is a little bit of folk wisdom from Benjamin Franklin, who said, failing to prepare is preparing to fail. So now is the time to prepare. The signals are clear. We've got a map to do it. Let's do it now.
Well said, Brent. Maybe we can recap, because I think there's a lot that we've covered in this Fresh Looks episode. At the trade compliance level, take a fresh look at your risk assessments. Are you incorporating the high probability standard into those assessments? How do you do that? Make sure that your risk assessments are holistic and that they take a broad look at your company's trends over time. That's data that you generate and that you can rely upon. Make sure that they are dynamic in the sense that they are not looking at static moments in time, but instead are looking at how trade flows have changed across time, with a particular emphasis on key dates. We talked about the battlefield effect. If an ally or friend of the United States recovers your item in a missile and a weapon, and that weapon has killed people, that's going to be a difficult spot to be in. From a board and management perspective, what does all this mean? Don't just accept as an answer, well, we've got someone in charge of export controls. Ask, how does what we are doing to manage our export controls risk reflect the current enforcement environment, the current geopolitical environment, and the rediscovery by the regulators of this high probability standard for certain aspects of the controls? Get an answer to that in detail. That will help you manage your own risks as a director or a C-suite officer, especially if you're a Delaware corporation or organized under a U.S. state that follows Delaware law, where there's a duty of oversight to manage your central compliance risks and to respond to red flags. I think I've summed it up. What am I missing, Brent?
That's it. I think it's beautiful. Like both.
Well, that concludes this episode of Red Flags Rising. Much, much more to come. Brent, be well.
Thanks, Mike. Be well.